Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs titled Moving On, Reconstruction and Reconciliation in Post-Genocide Rwanda. Our speaker is Anne Kubai, Associate Professor of World Christianity and Interreligious Studies at Uppsala University, Sweden. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Tim Longman, Director of the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs.
I'm happy to introduce our speaker for today, Anne Kubai. She is Kenyan by background, but has been doing a lot of work over the past more than a decade in Rwanda. She received her PhD in religious studies from the University of London, she taught previously Islamic studies at Kenyatta University in Nairobi. She has published on a range of different topics on Islamic Christian relations in Africa, on women. She's edited two volumes, one on Christians and Muslims in Africa, and another, Women, Religion, HIV, and AIDS in Africa. She's currently at the Center for Multidisciplinary Studies on Racism within the Department of Theology at Uppsala University. So I won't take more time. Let me hand things over to Anne Kubai.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be given this opportunity to travel here and come and speak about Rwanda. Rwanda is one of my favorite, if not favorite, subjects. So I'm very happy for this opportunity. And I tend to talk a lot, and somebody asked in Birmingham in 2005, why is she smiling when she is talking about such a horrible thing? So I try not to smile, but I am like that. Then somebody else said, I know, she's like that. So I'm like that. Even when I speak about Rwanda, sometimes I smile when I'm talking about terrible things. Yes, I have been doing this work for 20 years now, and sometimes I have very terrible photographs that I have taken myself that I might show you at the end if you have the nerve for it, the guts for it. But first, we speak about other things before we come to the horror stories. This is my reflection, actually, over the last 25 years, what the Rwandans have been doing. And that's why I'm very grateful for this opportunity, because this is just a reflection about the last 25 years in Rwanda and how they have tried to reimagine, to remake themselves, and what they have been doing actually can be called in different words, social engineering, but I don't want to use that. It can be called reconstruction in a post-genocide context. It can be called all sorts of things. And so I have been trying to reflect on this, and I started this reflection in 2016, and I presented the idea in the German Institute of Development, and somebody there was from Rwanda. They really didn't like what I said. So sometimes I don't know whether to be careful when I speak about Rwanda and how careful I should be, or should I just be honest and frank and say what I think and feel. Because if I do that inside Rwanda, I will be in jail. But I'm too far from Rwanda now, so I can afford to say exactly what I think. It's Rwanda nziza. It's beautiful Rwanda. And actually, it is. That's what they call it, Rwanda nziza. You can see. I took that photograph when I was going to Nsinda prison. I'm sure you know that it is the most densely populated country in the continent, and it's a very small space with the population of Sweden. If you compare, actually, it is exactly the population of Sweden, and it's a very small country, 26,000 square miles. Or kilometers, sometimes I don't know if it's miles or kilometers, but I think it's kilometers. And in 1994, they killed themselves. They killed 1 million people. And what is peculiar about Rwandan genocide, and like most of the genocides that we have studied, is that people killed people that they knew. No one killed a person that they didn't know. And it was mainly one-to-one with small implements, with small things that I will show you in the photographs. And if somebody came to a roadblock and he wasn't known, he would be sent to his village, he would be sent to people who know him, so that they would be sure of one thing, and only one thing, that he has the right blood, because they told me the whole time it is the blood that runs in your veins that determines whether you should be killed or not. So they were always sure they did that, and we know cases where a woman had two sons and one had to die and the other one had to live. So that's the background. Anyway, all this can be traced to a very old history in Rwanda, where the changes that started in the 19th century, people began to feel that they were completely... They felt they were superior. And this whole idea about God-given superiority was getting... making inroads in the society's psyche. And they came to believe that they were so different and that they could not reconcile their differences. And gradually, the society was moving towards genocide. But what I would like to emphasize, rather than talk about the history of genocide, is what I consider to be actually the idea that this whole Rwandan affair revolves around. This is the question of ideology. Rwandans are very, very familiar with the notion of ideology, more than most societies, actually, that you can look at their history and see that for Rwanda, it is the ideology that works. It's the ideology that mobilizes society to act, to think, to do something. So these ideologies, I think that one can identify trajectories of ideologies in Rwanda's history, how they have been used at different times for different purposes. So at the beginning, it was a change of the social institutions about land ownership, about cattle ownership, about social changes, the chiefs from the hills and the chiefs from... all this happening and a social change occurring, but within an ideology, because we know social changes have occurred in other societies and genocide hasn't occurred because of that. But in Rwanda, this is brought to bear on what people think, on what people do in their daily lives. And that's why, to cut it short, after independence, during the first republic, the new president was warning that if things continue as they were, the Tutsi race was going to be wiped out completely or off the surface of the earth. And that became a very important statement that he made in 1964. President Kayibanda was the first president after the independence. But we say he was the first. He actually wasn't the first. There was a Hutu president that was a few months there before Kayibanda, but we don't hear very much about him in history. I don't know why they don't say so much about him. But Kayibanda became famous because of this statement. And after him, of course, came General Abiarimana, and that way the society was moving closer to the genocide. And after the 1959 revolution, when the missionaries, the Flemish missionaries, came and turned the ideology around and reversed, now that the Tutsi had been the superior ones, the Flemish missionaries brought the notion of the sociological majority, who are the Hutu were 85% and the Tutsi were 15% or so, and the Twa, which you never hear about, were 1%. So anyway, after all these changes happened, what is important to note is that there is a consistent use of the notion of a racist ideology that goes through all the steps from the First Republic, the Second Republic, and finally we are moving towards the 1994 cataclysm of the genocide. So what I've done before is to interview many people in Rwanda. I've interviewed 138 prisoners of genocide. I have followed them in the teach, the nearly 2 million people, 1,998,000 in the what is called the teach, which is it is this you call public service when you have minor crimes or public service of sorts. But this is not that. It's given another meaning again, as usual. It becomes part of the ideology to get to mobilize nearly 2 million people to work for free, to build schools, to build roads, to build hospitals, and public works without pay. And when you look at them and talk with them, they say they feel like slaves, but that's another story. Anyway, I followed them inside the prison, this 138, outside the prison, and I went to their families to try and understand the impact of being genocidaire and being identified as such. Of course, there's a lot of work on the survivors as well, but far less work on the perpetrators, and that's why I have a keen interest on the perpetrators, and I've followed them for more than a decade to see what happens, to just see how they're being mobilized and how ideologies are changing and how Rwanda is trying to create a new society. So immediately after the genocide, of course, we have society divided into three groups, and the ideology now is to see how can they bring about reconciliation. So then go back to the ideology, the same ideologies that they had. And this time around, the idea is to ensure there is reconciliation. So how can you have perpetrators and survivors living side by side in the villages as if nothing happened? This is actually difficult if you think about it, because I have been to Kibuye, Kisenyi, and places where you find in one village there is 1,000 perpetrators who have come back, and then there is maybe 200-300 survivors, and they live side by side. So how does that work? It's difficult in real life. That's why the Rwandans decided, since this is difficult, we need a counter-ideology to deal with this, to facilitate life once again, because people cannot live as if nothing happened. So transitional justice was the way out, and they reinvented the famous gachacha, which was an ancient traditional way of settling scores, of looking at common problems, and if someone has stolen another person's cow, because cows are important in Rwanda, you would sit under a tree, mugachacha, that's what it means, on the grass, and they would say, so-and-so has taken your cow, therefore he returns the cow, and you take back the cow, and there's a penalty or there's no penalty. But then this was reinvented so that they could use this system, because they had already destroyed all the infrastructure. There was no courts. If they had to go to courts, they would require 120 years to try everyone, and enormous amounts of resources which were not there. So the gachacha was put in place, reinvented. Genocide perpetrators classified into big ones, small ones, and those who killed, those who destroyed property, those who were leaders, and so forth, into four categories. But more important, 266,000 people were trained, including judges and clerks, people who haven't been to any school of law and or even to school at all, and they drove 11,000 gachacha courts across the country. And they tried so many people within 7 years, while ICTR took 14 years and they used $2 billion and tried 65 people and left 300 of them at large and brought no justice to Rwanda. So gachacha seems to have served a very good purpose. At the beginning, I was also critical, like other scholars, about gachacha, but I came to believe perhaps there was no other way to do it. Because if we kept talking about international standards, we were not going to get a chance to apply any international standards in this particular case. And Rwandans have always been undermined that you tell us about international standards, where was the international community when the Rwandans were killing themselves? And that actually provides a license for Rwandans now not to worry about what the international community thinks about how Rwanda does its things and who sets the standards. Anyway, what has happened now, in summary, is that Rwanda decided to rely on its own culture to find solutions, regardless of what other people felt or thought about that. And one of the most thorny issues to deal with was the Hutu Tutsi dyad. How do you deal with this identity issue? And what happened was the 203 constitution, which set the path that Rwanda was going to really follow, to reinvent itself. First, there is the 1996 law, which established several institutions, including the Gacaca, including the National Unity Reconciliation, but the constitution of 203 was revised. And in the revision, there was no mention of Hutu and Tutsi that was criminalized. And if anybody trivialized the genocide, they would be punished. Or if anybody denied the genocide, that was a crime. Or if anybody was found to be encouraging divisionism, quote unquote, that was also punishable in law. So this was the direction that they were going to take, and that they have taken since. But how can this be done? So Kagame decided that the way to go is to change the mindset and to create a new moral order in which there is trust, because it is believed it was the lack of trust which brought about the genocide, the trust between the communities, especially the Hutu and the Tutsi. And then there should be a new national narrative so that everyone feels that they are not Hutu or Tutsi, but they are Rwandans, and they take on a new overriding national identity. So the culture provides an ideology or ideological tool for reshaping the socio-political landscapes and interrogating the individual relationship with the state and with one another on issues of rights, duties, and privileges. This was the key now to the changes that were expected. But one thing that is, I find in all this, in most of the work, of course, there is a work of Staub, but Staub is a psychologist and he talks about the mind of a perpetrator. I don't take that kind of line of inquiry myself, but I look very much at these psychosocial dimensions. And I think most of the research on Rwanda has left the psychosocial dimension out, except for looking at the mind of the perpetrator or at the impact, the psychological impact on the victims. But I look at the psychosocial dimension of things because I believe that this whole notion of mindset change, of creating a new moral order and a new national narrative, has a very important element, which is psychosocial, when it's being organized, planned, and people are being mobilized. And I will say a little more about that. I've been lately doing psychosocial studies in Colombia, in Nepal, and also in Syria, to see how this works in conflict situations. And that's why I have done a little comparison, especially with Colombia. I did it last year. Yes, I was in Colombia last year. And then also the year before, I was in Nepal, and I was close to the border of Syria, not daring to get in, but talking to people in Syria through technology and things like that. Because I'm thinking all the time, there is this element that has always been either not given due attention or ignored. And in conflict situations, the psychosocial dimension is very important. And it is also very important in reconciliation, in building relationships. Because what Rwanda is trying to do is to control how people build relationships, what kind of relationships people build in their families, as we are going to see, with each other, the types of friendship that they have, the evening clubs for mothers, so that they go there and discuss how to cook food and things like that, as we are going to see. So, to do all this, the first thing the government did after the constitution was to systematize forgiveness. So you give an apology if you're a perpetrator, and you as a survivor, you are bound. You must accept. First, this whole notion of forgiveness was started in the prisons by Rwanda Prison Fellowship. I have interviewed this guy that brought this whole thing there because he had lost his family, and he went and preached to prisoners and told them that if they confess and if they give apology, God will forgive them, and they can also be forgiven by the victims and the survivors. There was a lot of resistance, but then gradually the perpetrators began to see the point, because the government grabbed the notion of forgiveness, confession. And so if you confessed and you are ready for a charger, then you would be, your time would be commuted. And so who wouldn't want this kind of a benefit, as we will see. And also some were genuinely willing to confess because they couldn't sleep at night, as they said, and that would help them. They would also go and give apology to the victims out there in the villages. So forgiveness then and apology became a public matter. And then the church came in to insist that if you are a Christian and a good Christian, you must confess, because in the Lord's Prayer you forgive those who trespass against you. And you cannot come for the Holy Communion if you are not forgiving. And the government says you should forgive. So the two reinforced. And don't forget, in the old ideology, I keep going back to this because I see the connection for me. The old ideology, and Mamdani says this very clearly in his book, quote unquote, were it not for the church and the army, there would have been no genocide in Rwanda. That means the government and the church. Once again, it is my view that the church and the government once again come back together, as always, anyway, and they form this unholy alliance, or is it a holy alliance? I don't know. Sometimes I say unholy alliance, depending on who I am. So I say unholy alliance. And they reinforce each other so that they formed the Christian Gachacha, and those that were not in the Catholic Church, the Anglican, they had their own similar activities to insist that people must confess and that others must accept the forgiveness. We know very well that forgiveness cannot be, it has to be individual. Even an apology has to be individual, because you can't expect something like that to be done en masse. But in this case, it became public. So there was public space created for it. And conformity and the acceptance enforced. And that's what I'm calling systematizing of forgiveness and apology. Because this is the whole concept of confession, apology, forgiveness, ideology that is brought to bear on the situation and make people to speak out and make others to accept. And therefore, if you have accepted, then there is no reason why you would not live together with your neighbor that killed your family, or your children, or your husband. And I have seen in many cases where we know someone whose son marries the daughter of the man who was killed by, now, two men in a village living in the same neighborhood. One man killed the other. And now his son has married the daughter of the man that was killed, because they have reconciled. And then I visited a woman in Rwamagana, not too far from Kigali, and she was living with a nephew who had killed three of her children and her husband. And you ask, why did you do this? She says, he is family. And by the way, we have forgiven each other. So this is the kind of change that Rwanda wants to work for, that Rwanda wants to achieve. That you must have a changed mindset for you to be able to do that. I know it's very difficult. Initially, I was talking about the contradictions of forgiveness, and I was quite critical. But later on, I came to realize, no, confession and forgiveness required some sort of infrastructure. That's what I came to think. Because, why? Without some infrastructure, without systematizing it, it wasn't going to work. If it was just left to the whims of the people, then they wouldn't forgive each other. And then they wouldn't do anything. And I'm not justifying. I'm only saying for it to function, for it to work, there had to be some kind of organization, systematization. The product of that is one matter, but at least that had to be done. And it was done by the government. Through NAC, through different institutions, the National Unity and Reconciliation Commission was the one that was driving this reconciliation process, and of course all the other institutions that were built. But this question of change of mindset now is the ideology, and this must succeed. So how do you do it? Kagame is the chief architect. And the first thing, as I said before, was to make sure that he deconstructs, or rather, to deconstruct the old Hutu-Tut dyad and construct a national identity that is overriding. And this is Ubunya Rwanda, Rwandan-ness, so that everybody feels that ndi Munyarwanda, I am Rwandan, I'm a Rwandan citizen. It's deeper than just saying I'm American or I'm Kenyan. It's not that. It's something more, something much more. And Rwanda wants to be seen differently, because it has re-imaged, recreated itself. If you go to Kigali, it looks very clean in the streets. You might wonder whether that is something different or whether that is something important, or why am I talking about this in the first place? First of all, when I went to Kigali, as Tim knows, it was very dusty, long time ago, and all that stuff. But now you see women with little brushes, little... we have in Africa this broom, which is not a broom, but it's a bunch of, is it branches? Sticks you put together and tightly knit it together, and you have now a broom. Like the one you see with the witches of the 15th century England, that type. Not the modern broom, but that type, this way. And you see them on the streets. And these are the streets which are... going to the airport, this road, and the other big ones. But if you look in the valleys of Kigali, most of it is the same old slum type of Kigali city. Why am I talking about this? This is important because when I used to live in Kigali, it started then, and in Kismenti, in this small center, where it's just before you go down towards the airport, the shops were facing the road. No. There was instructions that you just change and the shops should face the back. Why? Because on this road, the president passes when he's going to the airport. And it's a security matter. So all the shops in Kismenti, in that big building, they had to change and face the back. So we went to go to the shops through the back. And this is like a small example, but I began to notice, what is it? What's happening, you know? And I realized, no, it's beginning to change. It doesn't feel the same again. So it's the least corrupt country in Africa, that's true. Of course, it has the highest number of women in parliament, even higher than Sweden, higher than Finland, 65%. So what does that tell you about Rwanda? That means Rwanda is ahead of everyone else. Rwanda is moving ahead. Rwanda now is getting so developed so very fast that it's even doing better than those developed countries. Of course, this is necessary if you're trying to reinvent yourself, if you're trying to give a new image about yourself. You need to do such things. You need to be different. But dissent is considered as divisionism. And remember, in the 203 Constitution, divisionism is a crime. Because it aims to take Rwanda back to the days of genocide. And Kagame says that Rwanda will not tolerate voices that promote a return to ethnic divisionism that precipitated the genocide. And he really says we have only two strategic tools, in his opinion. And one, let's change how people think, and two, shape how resources are allocated and later on utilized. Rwandans are ordinary people with an extraordinary history. This taught us some important things. You don't need to have all the answers or all the funds to get started. Constantly assess and correct course, but don't wait for perfection or rescue. That is what is behind this whole process. So, for every stage, I conceptualize this change of mindset in this way that I'm going to show. But before that, we have traditional institutions. Culture is the tool. Institutions such as Ingando, these are solidarity camps where people are trained how to think as Rwandans. And this is for everyone, school teachers, government officers, ordinary people, everyone has to go through this kind of training. And then there is the National Civic Education that also teaches people good cultural values. And then there is the evening club for parents where they go and learn how to cook good food, how to behave as family members, and how to think like quote-unquote empowered families. So this is the way it's done. It's that deep. The change has to be that deep. The people of Rwanda, they follow, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which is which, they follow the instructions and the law and the rules, and they obey almost to the letter. I don't know whether that is good or not good. I don't know, and on the surface. But also, they do not show publicly if they don't resist publicly something. But I know people in Rwanda speak in whispers about the unspoken, the unspeakable. And the silence is extremely loud. I have a chapter which is called Listening to Silence. And because you have to listen to silence in Rwanda to understand what people are saying. You have to listen to silence to understand what people are thinking and what people are feeling through silence. So, institutions of learning about citizenship, about how to behave, about how to cook a balanced diet, how to organize mass weddings for people who have been living illegally, cohabiting. That's not good for people. So you see, it's organized mass weddings so that people will live okay, in an okay way that is acceptable. People have been living together for 20, 30 years, but then this has to be done. And the women have to go with their children in the evening to learn a lot about how to keep a family that is Rwandan, a family that is clean, and a family that is quote-unquote empowered. So this, especially this one, I get quite amused about this one. This Umugoroba wa Babiei, this club for the women, usually it was for the women, but now everyone goes. And it promotes harmonious self-sufficiency or self-sufficient families based on Rwandan values. And this way you don't see the inherent coercive element of the program. It is masked away by everything else. And it is connected to all the other programs, this particular one. Because it's so much at the grassroots level, it's I think closest to what I call the grain of society, this particular one. It is really very, very close to the grain of society. That's where a change of mindset should start. That's where it should occur, at the roots of society. And of course, this is connected to sustainable development, SDGs and all that stuff. Use of participation, mobilization. You should see on Saturday, the last Saturday of the month, everyone has to go out and do Umuganda. And Umuganda is this free kavi type of labor, which was used by the ancient kings to make the people to work. But now, you don't do that. You go out and clean the streets, and if you don't go out, you have to close your shop, you have to close your business. Maybe you sleep at home. My friends tell me they stay at home and they lock the doors if they are not going to go, because you have to go. Kagame is there with his Wellingtons, so you have to go. Otherwise, you stay at home and hide yourself there. But the interesting thing about this is Umuganda is very important. It is Umuganda which was also used to mobilize people to go to commit genocide, to go to kill, because they were going to work then and work now. And they do this because it results in hard-working citizens who are committed to improve their own lives and living conditions. This is the idea behind all this, driving this all the time. This cohesive kind of way of doing things has to be justified through the development discourse, self-reliance. So when I interviewed some of people in prison, they said, you see what? When there is a snake in a gourd, you know what's a gourd? Calabash, but before you open it. When you open is when it's a calabash. Before you cut it across and open and have it open, it's a gourd. Have you seen it somewhere? Yeah. If you have now a gourd and there is a snake inside, this is what they told me in Nyanza prison. What will you do? The snake is not coming out. You shake, it doesn't come out. What you do is break the gourd. However valuable it is, precious or not, you break it. So they broke the gourd, but now they have to mend the gourd. And that's what I'm talking about, the psychosocial element here. This mending for me is a psychosocial thing. And so they have to mend it. And mending a gourd in traditional practice is a very tedious and meticulous job. But why I like the imagery is not because it's tedious and meticulous, because that is what change of mindset actually is all about, but because when people are ready for confession and forgiveness, they are also going out to atone for their relatives. I have interviewed two people, a young man and a woman, and what they have done is they have joined the TIJ, the one I talked about, this free labor for months in construction sites. And I asked the woman, why are you here? She said, because my father committed genocide and he died before he atoned for himself. So I am working all these months, 6 months, to atone for him. And she went on to say how this happened, how she went to the family of those people that survived and they lost their family members through the father's actions. She went and offered apology on his behalf. And now she is punishing herself through the teach on his behalf because she has gone through a change of mindset. And the young man said the same. So this to me is what this change looks like. And I spoke to someone. He said, don't speak to me like that after this education that they have gone through, re-education in the Ingando and the Itorero, these solidarity camps and the National Civic Re-Education Program. And the man said, I'm a former Hutu. I said, what? I'm a former Hutu. I said, oh, you are a Hutu, yeah? No, I'm saying I'm a former Hutu. I said, can you explain? And he explained. And I was actually surprised because I don't see how you can be a former Hutu. Former. You have been born a Hutu and raised a Hutu. So how can you become former? But you see, after training in the Ingando, after training in the Itorero, you now have a new mindset. The change has occurred. So you are not the old person you were. Now you are a new person with a new mindset. So you are former Hutu. Now you are only Munyarwanda. You are just a Rwandan and former everything else. So for people to come to that level, it's a lot of work of mending the good that goes into it. But some critics are saying that the government has neutralized or eliminated non-state spaces, therefore rendering these spaces that they are doing this mindset a suspect. Truth about the cause of genocide, of course, is not discussed very much because if divisionism means that you are talking about Hutu and Tutsi, yet people in Rwanda cannot be anything else. You are either Hutu, Tutsi, or Toa. And instead of saying, yes, you can be Hutu, Tutsi, or Toa, and then on top of that, you are a Rwandan. No, you are not Hutu, Tutsi, or Toa. You are just Rwandan. So that is very difficult to get to work. But people are not supposed, as I said, to resist openly. So they will say they are former Hutu and they will accept it. But that doesn't tell us why the genocide happened. So even if people are offering apologies and others are accepting, if you go back to the discussion as to why the genocide happened, you are bringing about divisionism. So the biggest threat that this ideology addresses for people in Rwanda is the genocide ideology. A commission was appointed by the Senate in 2003 after there were 30 people killed in some place because they thought it is a matter of genocide ideology. And I have seen a lot of studies. I've seen 7 studies on the prevalence of genocide ideology. It is in schools. In some schools, it's 90%. It's in some sectors, public sector, private sector, it is, I don't know what percentage. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the definition that the Senate committee gave it, it's so fluid, it's so vague. It means trivializing the genocide. It means minimizing the genocide. And I'm quoting, it means denying the genocide. It means divisionism. What do those words mean? I don't know. But that's what it means. So anybody who is found minimizing genocide, denying genocide, he or she is peddling genocide ideology, as it is called, and that is punishable in law. So what I want to say with this is that for people to be mobilized, there is this fear. There has to be some imminent thing that's going to happen. There is some fear. There is the ideology of fear that something is going to happen. So now we have the genocide ideology. That is the fear. And remember, before the genocide, there was the fear that the Ingotanyi, the Inyenzi, the RPF, whatever they were called, would come and invade if nothing was done. And that's why people are mobilized to do genocide. And now people are mobilized because the same genocide ideology is there, but it's reversed. I hope I'm making this clear. Things are reversed, but still the same fear now of the genocide ideology is the one that motivates this whole architecture of mind change. There has to be some ideology that creates this idea that something is imminently going to happen unless we do something. And Rwandans are very familiar, once I said again, with the notion of ideology. And participating is also in the psyche of the Rwandan people. That is why they must always participate now as they did before. And mobilization for participation becomes something quite important. So what I have been thinking about is really what can we say about this whole notion of forgiveness. I was thinking initially forgiveness is something that should happen, something that should be complete, something that should be some kind of utilitarian idea and something that should be achieved. No, now I don't think that anymore. I've been converted on the way to Tarsus. I don't believe that. And I don't believe that because I have followed quite a large number of Rwandans for more than 20 years to see how this works. And I have this woman, for example, that I met in Remera. I used to live in Remera. And I used to go and drink milk in some place so that I can meet people. And there we were sitting drinking milk, and a man comes and they greet. And in Rwanda, how to greet each other is to hug. And so this woman hugged the man and they greeted. And when the man had gone, she said, "Did you see that man?" I said, "Yeah, I saw him." She said, "What?" "He confessed," because the church says you confess, "that he killed my family. He confessed to killing 4, my nieces and nephews. I forgave him for that. But he didn't confess to 2 murders, and he knows that I know that. And for that, I didn't forgive him." So I began to think, so forgiveness is divisible. So it can be imperfect. So there are things you can forgive, and there are things you cannot forgive, and they still move on. That's why I'm thinking about this moving on. Because when I ask Rwandan people, they say, "We are moving on. We have to move on. We can't be stuck in one place. We can't be stuck with the genocide forever. We have to move on." Some women told me, just like Barrett's title of the book, genocide lives in us, but we have to move on. So I realized, yes, there is a lot of contradictions in forgiveness and apology, but we should not expect a perfect forgiveness, because, or reconciliation for that matter. There is no such thing, actually. Now I believe there is no such thing as perfect reconciliation. I also believe, I've come to believe, that there is no such thing as healing for people who have gone through mass atrocities. And people are peddling this idea about healing. No such thing. That's what I've come to believe. And I can really explain why I think like that. I have tried to check also in Nepal, where they never systematized these things, where they never asked people to tell the truth. And I know what has happened in Nepal is very different now from Rwanda, of course, but still, when it comes to mass atrocities, there are some basic similarities. And in Colombia, I was there when they were giving up the arms to the UN and all that, and I've been talking with people there. And they are very confused at this stage because everything is very psychologized. 9 million people, each one will be given psychological care? I don't know. So every country takes its own solution. And of course, when you look at all these solutions, then you begin to think some of the ideas that have been developed, like healing for this, might really not work. That's why I came to this conclusion. Now, this woman told me, look, that man, our eyes never meet. I hugged him and greeted him, but because he knows about those two murders, and I know, and he knows I know, that's why our eyes don't meet. But we are reconciled, but our eyes don't meet. I mean, it's so internal, it's so personal, it's so deep. That's something that even if you systematize forgiveness, that bit you can't deal with. And that's why I think even the healing is at that level. However psychological you go in your approach to it, you don't get that deep. You don't make those eyes meet of those two people, however you do it. Because the church makes sure you do what you need to do. So that woman goes for confession, she goes for Holy Communion because she forgave anyway. And the government can't say that she never forgave. But those two people, that's not a situation of healing and not healing. It is a situation that should be perhaps discussed and understood in different terminologies. That's what I am struggling with at the moment. Yes, I think I should finish there. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Anne Kubai, Associate Professor of World Christianity and Interreligious Studies at Uppsala University, Sweden. Professor Kubai's lecture was titled Moving On, Reconstruction and Reconciliation in Post-Genocide Rwanda, and was presented by the Boston University Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Tonight's moderator was Institute Director Professor Tim Longman. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.